Welcome to the CHIME Opioid Action Center podcast, where healthcare leaders explore how technology is making an impact in the fight to end the opioid crisis. Here's today's moderator.
Hey, welcome. I want to thank you for joining us on this episode of the CHIME Opioid Action Center. I'm the moderator. My name is Todd Bowen. I'm a physician and I'm the chief medical officer of Motive Health. And I feel lucky to be a moderator today. Our guest is Dr. Denny Morrison, who's a PhD psychologist. He's also a very active health information technology consultant. So he combines those backgrounds, done a lot of work for NetSmart and other companies over the years. So I just really want to welcome you for joining us today, Denny.
Thanks. Good to see you, Todd. As you know, we've known each other for 100 years.
That's right. That's right. So we'll have to avoid talking about our long-term relationship, but it's needless to say it's built on a lot of trust, and we'll talk about that more. So Denny, your career has spanned leading behavioral healthcare facilities, mergers of large networks, and then your current role in the technology world of behavioral healthcare is really interesting, and it leverages all this experience. So I think our audience would really like to hear, you know, kind of a brief description of your journey, and then we'll have more information about that available as well.
Sure. Yeah, as I mentioned, I'm a psychologist by training, but I've got a background in physiology as well. I did a stint in the Navy as an aerospace physiologist, for example, and I got to do some very interesting things with hyperbaric physiology. But my main background is psychology. I ran a community mental health center for 13 years and helped facilitate a merger of that mental health center with three other mental health centers, creating a two-state network. And when we did that, we took all the research and IT assets of the four companies, moved them into a new company that I ran, and did that for 4 years, where we did primary research in behavioral health and substance use disorders. And I had all the IT responsibilities, including merging four electronic health records across two non-contiguous states. I moved from there to did about 6 years as NetSmart's chief clinical officer. NetSmart is the largest EHR company in the behavioral health space. And about 6 years ago, I resurrected my consulting practice, turned NetSmart into a client, and I have other clients, one of which, for example, is a AI startup, actually it's fairly mature now, for behavioral healthcare, has created a line of products that will analyze psychotherapy sessions, summarize the sessions, write the beginnings of the progress note within 2 minutes of the end of the session. So I've kind of lived at that intersection of clinical and technology, much like you have, Todd. And but on my side has been primarily behavioral health and information technology.
Yeah, and I think this is great because it aligns really with the themes and the work that the Opioid Task Force is doing over the next 2 years, which include promoting best practices, supporting emerging technologies, and establishing and maintaining partnerships. So, you know, we're going to get into that. And earlier we were having a really good conversation around kind of the culture and the relative disconnect that still continues on between acute care and behavioral health care, and why we maybe aren't seeing as much care coordination and information sharing as we should be.
Yeah, I think when I think about this, there are kind of two facets to this. One of them is, as you mentioned, the cultural side of it, because we have, all of us who are trained as clinicians have been trained in a certain way. I mean, I know for behavioral health, it is just hammered into us that you just don't share information without lots of reasons to do so, because, you know, a lot of mental health information and substance use is very sensitive information. And I think medical side providers are much more used to informal communication about shared patients. And so I think medical providers historically have gotten frustrated with behavioral health providers because we wanted all these, you know, we're hesitant to give information. And if you referred somebody to us, we wouldn't get back to you to let them know how they did because we didn't think we should share information. So, and that's all cultural. I mean, there's some regulatory aspects to that, but that is almost always exaggerated in terms of its importance. For example, if you and I are seeing the same patient, we can certainly communicate about that under HIPAA. because it's a shared patient. We're doing care coordination, but it's from the behavioral health side that has become a problem. The other big bucket is technology. And so technology oftentimes reflects the cultural biases that we have to deal with. And we know, as you know, that there are still HIEs out there that don't want to deal with behavioral health information. Part of that is because of the challenges of the regulatory stuff, but part of it is actually based on kind of a mythology, frankly. They just over-exaggerate the difficulty in doing that, and it's easier just to not have to deal with it. Well, you can't do health information exchange without behavioral health. I mean, you know, that's just, you know, there is no health without behavioral health, frankly. So,
right.
So, you know, there are technological solutions and challenges, and there are cultural ones.
So let me kind of build on that theme, you know, the culture and technology, and just, you know, put out just a brief anecdote about the work you and I and others accomplished back in Bloomington, Indiana in 2012, where your organization did build out a successful consent model that was compliant with CFR 42. And we were able to do emergency room alerts and work through the cultural issues and the technical issues to make that work. And so, you know, that was 12 years ago. So it can be done. But I think perhaps even more exciting is just kind of the more recent changes in the federal regulations that you were mentioning to me. And I wonder if you could kind of go over that and just kind of talk through that so that our CHIME members and audience could better understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody on this call is familiar with HIPAA. And probably if you're dealing with opioid use disorder, you're familiar or at least know a little bit about 42 CFR Part 2, which is regulated by the Substance Use and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. Just historically, you know, 42 CFR was implemented about in the 70s. And the point of it was to protect people who were having addiction issues. If they disclosed that and went into treatment, there would not be major repercussions from doing so. And so the essentially what it meant was there was a higher standard of confidentiality for people who are seeking treatment in Medicare reimbursed services and federally reimbursed services organizations. So that was fine for a while, but particularly with the implementation of meaningful use in that the need for electronic considerations and communication about care coordination, that really brought the fact that 42 CFR had kind of outlived its usefulness, and it was certainly not made for an electronic world. It was all back in the 70s, everything was in paper. So so fortunately, this has been a huge problem, and the company that I used to work for in SMART has been a leader in trying to get this changed because they're dealing with this electronic exchange issue all the time. And recently we have done so. So like as recently as February, HHS and SAMHSA have put out new regulations about the 42 CFR, which is a huge win. And it's a lot of details to it, but the short version is that 42 CFR now more closely aligns with HIPAA. So we don't have these very widely disparate ways of handling confidential behavioral health information or really addiction information. So they're much more closely aligned. And the whole point of it is to give people who have addictions the same level of freedom to communicate and do care coordination as someone with another chronic disease like diabetes or hypertension has, which they did not have with 42 CFR. It was incredibly encumbering to try to do care coordination with under the old regs. So this is a real win.
It sounds like this is really an accelerator.
Exactly.
All the CHIME members and the CIOs and all the folks in behavioral healthcare need to be learning more about and digging into. So let's talk about, you know, that's part culture. There's technology there too. But then, you know, one of the things we're all working on is these partnerships. And, you know, we're all having a really in-depth discussion about partnerships and how does that work in healthcare. And I wonder if you could kind of speak to what you think, you know, CIOs and the acute care side and leaders in behavioral healthcare, what should they be doing maybe at the local level and, you know, and how does that line up with the federal level?
Yeah, there's I believe all healthcare is local. And so where things happen is when, kind of like you and I did, but where people who have a shared interest, and that is shared patients particularly, if we are having trouble communicating about those patients, then let's sit down and figure out what that is. And that communication can be physical. It can be just that we just don't talk, or it can be electronic. And the technologies exist now for shared information to occur. Starting with meaningful use, we started getting the beginnings of a common language of how we are going to communicate, because before that, you know, every EHR had their own way of doing things. Well, you know, meaningful use did give us kind of the starting point of that, but there's care quality initiatives and other things like that that are out there where behavioral health and primary care providers are trying to bridge the gap and find more ways of sharing information electronically. We can't do that electronically unless there is a common language. You know, the old story about why ATMs flourished was not because ATMs got better, is because the language by which banks communicated in the background between ATMs allowed me to pull money out of my bank when I'm in Zurich, Switzerland, here out of the bank in Bloomington, Indiana. What allowed that to happen was there is a common transactional process for that to occur, compared to when ATMs were first offered, you could only get money out of your bank. And that was because there was no standard. Well, those standards are now being promulgated. So from the cultural side, people got to talk. And from a technology side, there are now ways in which we can communicate electronically, but there's got to be the motivation to do so.
Right. So, I mean, I think the take home for me is that build these local relationships, you know, meet and greet, you know, between acute and behavioral healthcare folks, compare technologies, and then try to learn from each other, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like the federal government with 42 CFR and other things is starting to say, look, you know, we're changing these things to make it easier. And so there's fewer excuses to not do this, is what I'm going to say.
Right. Yeah. And I know on the behavioral health side, the EHR vendors, particularly NESPAR, has taken the lead in building out the capabilities to share data. So that's why they were pushing this on the policy side, to get the standard language and get these barriers out of the way, because the healthcare, you know, there's a huge overlap in behavioral healthcare and primary medical care. And if we can't communicate about that, patient care will suffer, costs will go up. We know that integrated care and care coordination decreases costs and improves quality. We know that. So,
right. So, there's so much evidence to support that.
Absolutely.
And, we obviously, this is going to take leadership beyond the CIOs, right? We need the service line leaders and the other folks in the hospital to be thinking more holistically, kind of about this whole person care. And, you know, frankly, their outcomes on the medical side will be better.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's a win-win.
Yeah, you know, I've talked about this, about how, you know, you look at the relationship between depression and cardiovascular disease, and that the risk of a second heart attack is, don't quote me on this, but it's like something like six times greater for someone who goes through exactly the same procedure, a CABG or whatever. And, if they're depressed, their risk is, six times greater for a second heart attack. And that's the only intervening variable. So, you know, the flip side is true also. People who have chronic mental disorders, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, do not get good medical care. And so consequently, there's a whole movement now on the behavioral health side to set up these things called CCBHCs, Comprehensive Community Behavioral Health Centers. And what they are doing is bringing in substance use treatment, behavioral health care, and primary care, so that they are now on the hook for all of those, because the data has been so compelling that the feds are now putting money into this. Well, you still have an interface that you have to do with primary medical care and, you know, health centers, because they're probably not going to have their own inpatient unit. So they're going to have to, people who, when they need inpatient care, we're going to have to communicate with a local inpatient provider.
So, yeah, and I think that's a really good specific example of a partnership, right? These co-location, co-delivery of services. And, you know, I think increasingly the value-based care is going to be supporting that as well.
Yes.
And I'll just say that, you know, the company that I work with, the Mobile Cardiac Rehab, we have integrated behavioral health care and physical care. And we designed it that way from the beginning. And because it's outcomes, right? We're focused on the outcome, and we really want people to not, you know, we want to make that lifestyle change.
And it's important. I don't know how it's working on the medical side. I know we're starting to see some impact of value-based care. We've been talking about it for a long time, starting to see a little bit of it on the behavioral health side. But, you know, when I think about kind of reimbursement systems, I mean, the short version to me has always been in fee-for-service, the name of the game is do more, make more. In managed care, the name of the game is do less, make more. And in value-based care, it's do better, make more. And so if we can get all these incentives aligned and we get the, you know, we can identify what constitutes good outcomes and reimburse for that. And, you know, when we think about value, value is quality divided by cost. So you want to get the maximal amount of return for the best price, but price by itself is not the end result. That was the goal of managed care companies or managed care interventions. It was just save money. I mean, you know, without killing somebody.
And there's obviously, we're just scratching the surface of what we could talk about today. And I really want to thank you for the expertise, you know, and really clarifying for others, you know, how important people, process, and technology are together.
You bet.
And, you know, I think this is the beginning of hopefully some, you know, more partnerships between the acute care side and the behavioral health care side across the country. And I'm excited the work that Chime can do to facilitate that. So, anyone, to thank you for your time and insights today, and thank the audience for listening to the Chime Opioid Action Center podcast.